I just feel so bad for parents right now because I don't know how any average parent is supposed to navigate this. Like, how do you navigate it when the CDC, HHS says one thing, your doctor says a different thing, American Pediatrics says another thing, your social media influencer follower that you love says a totally different thing, the other one, it's like everybody's giving you wildly different opinions and you're like, I just want to keep my kid healthy. I don't want to give them a vaccine to my kid to get autism or some sort of problem. And my friend's kid got autism and they swear it's this. And, you know, my doctor says it doesn't cause autism. So therefore, I just don't know who to trust and what to do. And I don't want my kid to get a disease, but I also don't want them to have a bad reaction and they just feel stuck. And I think it's really hard right now because it's so confusing.
Dr. Joel Warsh, thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me on.
So you are a pediatrician actively, but you have a background in epidemiology. And it sounds like you've been, from what I understand, trying to help parents navigate the ever-challenging decisions around vaccinations.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a crazy, charged topic. I mean, I think that's unfortunate that it's so charged and political and I guess divided. But I mean, here we are. This is kind of what's going on. There's more discussion on vaccines than ever this year. And I never thought I'd be here. I never thought I'd be talking about vaccines or have anything to do with this. You know, I went to med school, did all the regular pediatric training, wasn't very, I guess, mindful about any of this stuff. Just kind of, you know, learned like every other doctor, oh, here's your schedule. Here are the horrible diseases. Here's how much better they are. Here's your vaccine schedule. You know, go. And that's really all that I thought about it at that time. I got into the integrative space. My wife's very holistic minded. And so that really opened up my eyes to integrative medicine, integrative health, started learning about it, thought it was really interesting. When I did some courses and training in functional medicine, I was like, oh, this is, you know, I thought we're kind of taught like, oh, it's woo-woo, it's out there. And I went and did some and I was like, wow, this is really interesting. Like learning about nutrition and diet and exercise, really none of this is all that woo-woo. And so that got me very interested in it. And I started practicing in that way. But what you realize really quickly, if you're in the integrative space, is there are a lot of parents that have a lot of questions about vaccines. They're certainly more hesitant than I was used to. And so it kind of forced me to learn more about vaccines and have more vaccine discussions. And I was doing that in the office, but couldn't really talk about it too much online. It was so censored. And I thought that was really unfortunate. But I, you know, kind of continued having those discussions, but not online. And then the pandemic hit, and I think everyone or many, many people got very frustrated with the public health messaging and kind of the back and forth and what happened with the COVID vaccine. Ultimately, that pushed me over the edge to say, like, look, I don't believe in the censorship. I don't believe in forcing people to do things. I'm not against vaccines. I think we need to have discussions. And we're seeing this pushback against public health and vaccines, and not having discussions isn't helping. We're actually going in the wrong direction. So that led me to write my book, Between a Shot and a Hard Place. And I didn't really know where that was going to take me. But luckily, I guess with the timing of what's going on, it hasn't really been all that crazy or as crazy as I thought it was going to be. It's been very positive and people have been very open to having discussions on vaccines. And I think that's been wonderful. So I've had a really good time, you know, chatting and doing things like this and having conversations. I'm not trying to make anybody get a vaccine or not get a vaccine, just have discussions and talk about what I know. And I guess that's kind of led me here.
That sounds great. And Between a Shot and a Hard Place is an awesome title for a book.
Thank you.
It's just a great name. It's interesting. One thing that is very apparent to me is that the some of the most important topics that demand the most conversation and have the most nuance get the least amount of conversation because of just the divisive nature of our culture now and how it's just everything's so black and white, pro, against, whatever. When really what we need and what we all deserve and should desire is deep, meaningful conversation. One, to understand, you know, more about like what we don't know and learn more about ourselves, about like what are our biases and how we're influenced. I mean, everything that is like shown to us through tools of, I mean, you call it propaganda, messaging, whatever, everybody's got some kind of agenda. And the first thing we should ask ourselves is like, how, whoever's behind this, how are they trying to influence me? And have that context so that we could I mean, if it's a real thing, be somewhat true to ourselves and try to come up with ideas on our own to some degree based on the information that we take in.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think that's most apparent almost in any topic in medicine, in vaccines, because everybody's trying to get you to do something. And for a long time when I was in the office and people would ask me, okay, so like, what can I read? Where could I go? What could I do? You know, the answer had to be like, you have to read more than one thing if you want to have any sort of understanding of the two sides of the vaccine debate. I mean, you have the very pro-vaccine kind of CDC mentality that's always been out there and those kind of books. And then you have the, you know, more air quotes, like anti-vaccine books that kind of discuss maybe the concerns around vaccines. And I think if you want to have a more nuanced approach, you needed to read both of those and kind of compare them. I mean, that's the way that I tried to do my book, was kind of talk about both sides and look at some of these topics, the big topics, autism, chronic disease, and look at, okay, what do we know from the CDC perspective? What do we know from some of the other books? And where is the middle, and what do we know and what we don't know? And yeah, everyone has a bias. I mean, I certainly have a bias of medicine, right? Of pharma, you know, and I think that's something that you would never think about. And I certainly never thought about 10 years ago. But the reality is, as a doctor, you're biased towards pharma. That's what we're taught, right? And that's not good or bad. It's just when something happens, we're taught, how do you treat it with a pill? And you really don't get any education in nutrition and root cause medicine and other modalities out there. And lots of medicine is great. I mean, we're very lucky we have pills. It's not that I'm antibiotics or something like that. Like, it can save your life, but there is a bias there.
That you're familiar with.
It's just the tools that you're familiar with. And so I think that's fine as long as you understand it. And my, you know, personal bias is I don't think people should be forced to do anything. Again, I'm not against vaccines. We give vaccines in our office. I have people that do the regular schedule, families that do a slow schedule, some that don't do it. I don't force anybody to do anything. And I think that's the way that it should be in general and the way that most places do it in the world. But I am not against people getting vaccines, and I'm not trying to get people to not get vaccines. I just think that there are a lot of people that are skeptical. I think the skepticism is at the highest it's ever been. If you look at the numbers, institutions, like, it used to be 70%+ of people trusted medicine and doctors, and now it's below 40%. So there's a lot that's not going well in medicine, and forcing people to do things doesn't work. And we saw that with COVID. I mean, it works in the short term. You can force people for an amount of time, but then they push back. And then you see where we were, let's say last year, before they took the vaccine off the recommended schedule. You were talking like 10% of people, 10% of kids or under were getting it, about 30% of adults. So most people, even though there was a strong recommendation to get it, weren't doing it. So forcing people doesn't work. What does work, I think, is educating people and having discussions and providing people with the best information possible and helping them to make the best decisions for their family. And ultimately, that may not be what I think is right. That may be different than what I think is right. And that's always been okay in medicine. We never force people to get blood. You know, you can be a Jehovah's Witness, not get blood. Like, these are things that you know, I might think that you should take some blood so save your life. But if that's not your religious beliefs, it's not your religious belief. It's not for me to tell you what to do. And if I believe a vaccine is good for your child, in this situation, it's not for me to force you to do it. I think it's up to the parents. And if they ultimately choose it's not what they believe in, we shouldn't be forcing people to do it. And most people do get vaccines. Most places around the world don't have requirements. Even most places in America don't have requirements. And still, most people do it. So I just don't feel that we need to force people to do it. And I think if we took away the requirements, it would bring the tension down. It would bring the temperature down so much. Because I think that's the biggest fear that a lot of parents have when it comes to vaccines, is that they're going to be forced to do something they don't want to do, like they saw in COVID. Maybe a new vaccine comes out, there's a new outbreak, there's something, you know, 2 years from now, and they're going to be forced to do that. And they don't want to be forced to do anything. They want to have that choice. They might choose to do it, but they don't want to be forced to.
Yeah, and they're also just, I mean, I think on a population level, the credibility of the institutions putting these out has really been jeopardized, and there's a big lack of trust. So, I mean, I know that I was probably skeptical of vaccines prior to COVID. And then, I mean, now I'm very skeptical about all of them. And I don't know if I'm right or wrong. I just know that I'm skeptical.
Well, I think it's right to be skeptical of all of pharma, right? I think right. It's weird.
Everybody
because,
used to be.
Right, everybody used to be. And that was like the normal. And we still are on almost every other thing. I mean, you know, we were like, oh, smoking, it's good for you, right? opioids. No, they're not addictive. Like we know that we should be skeptical of pharma. That doesn't mean that all of pharma is bad, that every medication can't help you, that a vaccine can never be good, can never protect your child. Of course, that's not true. But that doesn't mean you should trust them. They're right. Billion-dollar companies. Their job is to make money. And when they're coming out with a product, obviously they're going to try to show things in the best light possible. And they're going to try to show them the most efficacious they can and decrease the risks that they're going to show, so that way they can get their product on the market and more people are going to take it and they're going to make more money. There's nothing wrong with that. That's their job. Our job, the CDC's job, the FDA's job, the association's job is to push back and say, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, we need to get better proof. We need to follow up on this. We need to make sure that you're showing all your work that this is correct.
Have you ever wished learning could feel a little more natural, a little more connected to real life? That's why I want to share Time for Learning with you. If you are homeschooling or even supplementing your child's education, Time for Learning offers a flexible, all-in-one online curriculum for pre-K through 12th grade. What I love is that it supports real-life learning. You can create a schedule that works for your family, focus on certain subjects on certain days, travel when you want, explore passions, and still stay on track. They even offer cinematic, story-driven courses for middle and high schoolers that make learning visually engaging and emotionally rich. And for parents, it's simple. There are built-in planning tools, transcript templates, and grading support that meet requirements in all 50 states. It's been trusted by over a million students and families for more than 20 years. Whether you use it as your main curriculum, a supplement, or for summer learning, it's designed to give your family more freedom and confidence. I honestly wish I knew about this option when my son was homeschooling. I think it would have really helped. If you're curious if Time for Learning is right for your family, visit timeforlearning.com. That's time, the number four, learning.com, and explore their curriculum and find the perfect plan for your student. You can get started with a monthly subscription to see just how much your kids enjoy learning on their own terms. Most of us are trying to get healthier, but we're honestly guessing which habits actually matter for our bodies. We're buying supplements, following wellness trends, doing the workouts, and hoping something sticks. What I love about True Diagnostic is that it takes the guesswork out. They test your biological age and key health markers and then give you a clear, personalized 90-day plan based on what your body actually needs. I recently took the test myself for the second time, and what stood out most to me was how incredibly convenient it was. The kit arrived at my door, the finger prick was quick and simple, and I just dropped it back in the prepaid envelope. No appointments, no labs, no disruption to my routine. Now I'm waiting for my results over the next couple weeks, and I'm genuinely excited to see what's happening beneath the surface, especially around metabolism, nutrient status, and how my lifestyle is impacting longevity. True Diagnostic offers the True Age test, which compares your biological age to your chronological age and shows how fast you're aging, plus the health of 11 organ systems. They also offer True Health, which looks at over 105 biomarkers to understand your health right now. Or you can do the combo kit, which gives you both, and honestly, that's the best value. The process is simple. Order online, test at home, get digital results, and focus on just 3 actions for 90 days. You can do it once or use their quarterly subscription to track real progress over time. Right now, my listeners can get 20% off at truediagnostic.com using code MINDFUL20 at checkout. That's truediagnostic.com and use code MINDFUL20 for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the combo kit as a one-time purchase or subscription.
There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with caring about risks versus benefits when it comes to vaccines. It's not about saying you should never get a vaccine. It's about saying, okay, here are the benefits from this vaccine. What are the risks? What are the short-term risks? What are the long-term risks? And if you can't have those discussions, if we can't continue to look into that, if we can't continue to study it, if we can't update that research, then I think we're doing our kids a disservice, especially as we're adding on more and more vaccines and we're not studying them cumulatively. And we have this chronic disease epidemic that we're seeing. It is reasonable to say, how, if at all, are vaccines related to chronic disease? Because if you're vaccinated against something which is a very, very low risk of you getting it, like most kids never get it, these things aren't around very much anymore, you want to know what the risk from that vaccine is. You don't want a bunch of kids getting measles, but you have to ask, okay, but what is the risk from getting that vaccine? And then how do we weigh those two things against each other?
Do we still not understand the risks? Like, are there actual long-term studies at all showing like the risks, especially like layering so many. From what I understand, my kids are kind of grown now, so I don't know how the schedule or whatever has changed, but from what I understand, it's grown a lot. Like, there's so many that are piled on top of each other. First of all, is it even possible? Like, I would think that it's probably very challenging logistically to make studies to give you useful data about the risks. There'd be so much to tease out.
Yeah. It's very complicated, no doubt. You know, first point, there are a lot more vaccines than used to be. There's no question about that. I mean, on a positive sense, we're protecting against more diseases, so that part's good. But there are a lot more vaccines, and so obviously
allegedly protecting against more diseases.
Yeah, well, exactly. But let's just assume that they work and they protect you. So we don't have to go there for now. It's a whole other conversation. But let's just take the assumption that vaccines protect you against the disease that you're getting a vaccine for. So you have that protection. Then the natural next question is, okay, what are the risks? What are the risks for each vaccine? What's the risk for cumulative effects when you're getting a whole bunch of them? And does that benefit outweigh the risks for your child and your specific situation? What's the risk of each disease? I mean, that's the way we should be asking these questions so we can make decisions on that. Do we have research? I mean, there is some retrospective epidemiologic research on some of these questions, but any retrospective epidemiologic study is heavily biased. That's just the way that it is. And that's why prospective studies are much better than epidemiologic retrospective studies. So
I'm sorry, what does that mean?
So looking back in time, epidemiology is looking at data sets that we already have. So let's say you have some sort of electronic medical record. You could say, how many kids have asthma? And did they get their vaccines? Or you can ask very specific questions like, did you get your hepatitis B vaccine? Okay, what are the increased risks? So you're kind of looking backwards in time, but you have to take into account a lot of factors. There's a lot of bias in the information when you're looking at those. And you can certainly adjust for different factors like socioeconomic status, how many visits somebody had, and that can really change your data. So that's helpful first steps in terms of public health, but the best kind of research is following kids forward and watching kids over a long period of time. That's obviously harder research to do, but we've never really done that. And that's what we don't have. We don't have the more definitive research. Certainly we don't have cumulative studies of multiple vaccines, because if you think about the way that research is done, most of it is done on a vaccine before the vaccines hit the market. So the company's doing it. They're following maybe a few hundred, a few thousand kids. They're following them for a couple of months, not years, not decades, usually, 6 months, a year, something like that. They're not getting all of their vaccines, or they're really studying that specific vaccine. They're probably studying it against another vaccine. They're not studying it against an inert placebo in general. They're studying it against another vaccine. And so you certainly get some information, but I think given where we are with the concerns around vaccines, we do need to do the best kind of research now to get some of that information. And it's not impossible to do. It's just not the easiest research because it costs a lot of money. But you can certainly do vaccinated versus unvaccinated studies going forward. You're not going to be able to do a blinded study, meaning, you're going to give some kids the vaccines and some kids not give the vaccines, and they're going to not be able to choose. Like, you could choose. You could have people say, all right, do you want to get vaccinated? Do you want to not get vaccinated? If you don't want to get vaccinated, you're in this group, and you just follow kids forwards in that sense. We could do that, and that would give us very valuable information. So I think it's time to get that information. I think they are talking about doing some of that, so hopefully they will. But that I think is really needed, because this is such a hot topic that I believe we need that data to move forward, to help parents have the best information possible.
That makes sense. I have a question for you. I am not really well-versed on some of this stuff, but I've listened to some people talk about it, and I've read a little bit about it, but not much. But I think from what I've understood, which I could be wrong, that what people think a vaccine does is very different than what it actually does. I've heard the flu shot, which I guess that's considered a vaccine, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Flu shot.
Yeah.
People think that you get this, and then it means that if you get exposed, you won't get it. Which I feel like, to test for that or to create that, like, the idea would be, and I think there's this is called something. Maybe it's like Koch postulate or something. Like, you take an organism that's sick, you try to identify what you think is making it sick, you take that out of it, you put it in a healthy organism, and they should get the same kind of sick. And then you could draw some conclusions there. But you can't really do that kind of testing. Like, that's like third grade scientific method approach of like, you know, very logical of, is this the thing that we're going after? Are we right about what's making the person sick in the first place? And then the idea would be, okay, once you know that that's the thing making this person sick, you take another organism, you give them your vaccine, and then you expose them to that and see if they get sick or not. But you can't even test that way. Like, to me, my logic mind thinks that's what a vaccine should do. It should be something that we've tested where you give it to somebody, you expose them to what you think it's supposed to be protecting them, and then it does. And what I've learned, possibly incorrectly, is that it's more about there's a test you're failing or showing positive. I think they're generally the PCR tests, which I don't really understand how they work. And then the vaccine is designed to get you to test negative, but it's not necessarily tested on like sickness or non-sickness. It's about, does it make the test outcome what you want? Is that accurate? Because that seems like so not, far not removed exactly. From the first idea. It's not.
Yeah, okay. It's not exactly. I mean, there much of what you said is true to some degree. So it's not that what you're saying is incorrect. I would say, you know, at least from the vaccine perspective. So a vaccine in general, the goal would be to expose your body, to expose your immune system to a disease or a part of a disease before you ever get it. So that way you build an immune response. And that way, if you ever encounter it again, your body knows how to fight it and it will fight it off better, faster. So you won't get sick at all, or you won't get as sick as you would because you're going to be able to fight it off faster. So that's kind of the general role of a vaccine, is to kind of protect you from getting very sick, ideally, or not even get it at all. Every vaccine is different. Every vaccine does different things. So some of the vaccines are better in terms of stopping transmission, so you don't pass it on to other people. Some of them are better at making you to, you know, have no symptoms. Other vaccines just neutralize a toxin that's being in your body, like diphtheria or tetanus. So you're not actually stopping the disease, but you're just neutralizing the toxin so you don't get very sick. Other vaccines might decrease your risk of serious disease. So you may not be able to stop the disease totally or stop transmission, but hopefully your body can mount an immune response quicker. So you decrease the death rate, you decrease the severe consequences, you decrease the hospitalization. So a lot of the vaccines are more in that category, where it's not like you can't get it at all.
How do they prove that? Like, how do they prove that something would have been worse if you didn't get it?
I mean, that's where the research would come in. So they would be looking at two groups. They'd look at the group who got a vaccine versus not the vaccine, and then they would see how the outcomes were. So imagine you were looking at two groups, vaccinated and unvaccinated, for the vaccine, and they could look at how many deaths in each group. And if the group that got vaccines had 3 deaths and the other group had 20 deaths, you're assuming that the vaccine decreased that risk if the study was done well. So the better the study, the more you can prove that. And that's why, again, prospective randomized trials, in theory, you're controlling for all other factors. So the only difference of the two groups, in theory, would be the vaccine. And therefore, you can presume, you're hypothesizing that the vaccine works because there are fewer deaths. So that's how, you know, if different studies look at different things, they give you different outcomes. But I guess your greater point is, not every vaccine does the same thing. Not every, people do think, for sure, that you get this vaccine, you're never going to get sick, you're never going to pass it on. And that's not true. No vaccine is 100% perfect. A lot of them are pretty good, but they're never 100% perfect. And there are a lot of assumptions that go into immunology and virology that different people, different experts disagree on. But ultimately, in general, the concept is you get this vaccine, it decreases your risk to some degree. And that's also where people are, I think, disagreeing these days, because they're saying, okay, well, rotavirus is a perfect example. Or hepatitis B, people are saying, well, you know, let's say for rotavirus, like, the risk of death is really, really low in America. So should we really give every single kid a rotavirus vaccine when only a few kids, maybe 20 to 60 kids used to die from rotavirus, and now just a few do? So is that worth it? But then other people say, well, but we're also decreasing the risk of hospitalization. There used to be 20 to 50,000 hospitalization. So isn't that worthwhile? And that's where reasonable people disagree, because then the next question is, okay, but what is the risk from this vaccine? How many kids get sick from it?
What is rotavirus? What does that do to
rotavirus? It's a stomach bug, basically. So bad diarrhea, bad vomiting. So you get lots of dehydration. Generally, in America, it's not going to kill kids unless you were very unlucky.
Because aren't there other things to just help somebody through something like that? Like
there is. So that's the argument against it, right? So the argument against it in America would be that we have IV fluids. So for a kid who got really sick, you could get IV fluids. It's very unlikely you're going to die because we can rehydrate you. But other people would say, but, you know, it does decrease the amount of kids that get sick, the amount of kids that miss school, the amount of hospitalizations, because you don't necessarily want your kid to go to the hospital for IV fluids and get really sick. And so that's all true. I mean, it does decrease those risks. So that's where values come in, because one person might say, well, you know, I understand that it's going to decrease my risk, but I don't want to take this vaccine. I don't care that it decreases their risk a little bit of going to the hospital. I just don't want my kid to die. And if they happen to be that one kid that goes to the hospital, so be it. And other people would say, well, no, I don't want my kid going to the hospital, so I'm willing to take the vaccine. I think the risk of the vaccine is very small. And that's where we should be. We should have those discussions at the doctor's office, and you should understand your risks, and you should be able to, the doctor should be able to say, if you don't take this vaccine, your child's risk as we know it is this. This is what could happen to them. And you have to decide. Everything has a risk. A vaccine has a risk, and the disease has a risk. But what it's hard today, I think what's really difficult, and what I've been pushing for and what I continue to push for, is I think we need that research that explains and gets the data on what is the risk from the vaccines. Because you were missing that piece of the puzzle. That's really important.
Yeah,
if vaccines
sure.
cause problems, that's very different than if they don't. And people go back and forth and they argue whether they do or they don't, whether they're related to autism and chronic disease and these other issues. And that's a major factor. If you were to say, you know what, if you get vaccines, you increase your risk of getting autism by 5 times and your risk of autoimmune conditions by 5 times and your risk of allergic reaction by 10 times and seizure by 10 times. That's very different than saying it increases your risk of 1 in 10 million. Right. You have to know what those numbers are. And I don't think we accurately actually know those things. And so that to me is really important to be able to give true informed consent.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. And I think the entities behind making money from this just make it like they have no interest in devoting a lot of money into really teasing out those risks. So where would that come from? Like the only other place that would come from would be our government, I guess, but they're heavily influenced by the companies that are making, that are incentivized to not have those studies done.
Right. So it's a really, really important point to understand, because this kind of blew my mind when I started looking into vaccine stuff. And I mean, it's really crazy because I'm someone who's in the integrative space. I didn't know almost any of this until I was really writing my book. I knew a little bit about it, and the more I researched it, fine. But even until I really did a deep dive, I didn't know so much of this, and most people don't realize that vaccine companies are immune from liability. So you essentially can't sue them, and that's something that's put into place in the 1980s. So they actually have no incentive to find problems with their products. So most products, most things that hit the market, most pharmaceuticals, the biggest thing that they think about, the biggest problem that they think about is getting sued. They don't want their product to hit the market and some complication to arise that they get sued over, but you can't sue a vaccine manufacturer. So all of that incentive is gone for them to do safety research. So the best thing for them is to do the most minimal safety testing humanly possible that can get the thing approved. And then once it's on the market, they don't have any incentive really to study their product. What, like Pfizer's going to be like, oh, you know what we should do today? We should spend $1 billion to study for safety signals so that way we can find something and then take our product off the market when we do. Like, of course they're not going to do that, right? That's silly. So the only people that would do it would be the watch groups, you know, the watchdogs like CDC or FDA or whoever it would be that would say, well, you
they're
know,
they're also influenced by
right. So that's the issue is they, a lot of the people kind of go back and forth between these places. They're heavily funded by these associations, and the people who are on them, you know, historically have been very, very pro-vaccine. So you don't have an unbiased group of people that are sitting here being like, you know what, I think vaccines are bad. We need to have that research to look into that. Or I think that, you know, we should be more neutral on this. You have very, very pro-vaccine people taking this research and then rubber stamping it, as opposed to being the groups that are like, you know what, I don't trust pharma at all. Let's see if what they're sending us is correct. And that's kind of what we need. We need a watchdog not to say that, again, that vaccines are bad, but to say, like, you know, I don't trust these companies. Let me look at the stuff that they're presenting and see how they're finagling the data. And let's push back on them to say, you know, no. Like, you need to do your study this way. No. We want to see this. No, we looked at the data and where is this information? Like, there's a lot of that. And look at the COVID vaccines, like Pfizer. You know, they didn't want to give their research for like 100 years, right? It's like they don't want to show what's going on.
Kind of a red flag.
Right? It's a big red flag. Like, if you're like, no. We don't want you guys to even look at what we're doing. And let's keep in mind, when you give this stuff over to the FDA and the CDC, you're not giving them the raw data. You're just giving them the interpretation of what you're doing. So you don't have to show them everything. You can cherry pick out the best studies. You can get rid of things. You can hide things. You can interpret it how you like. You can adjust things how you like. You're not supposed to do that. But I mean, obviously, I'm sure they do. So...
This is why I'm such skeptic and a cynic. I mean, and not to mention it's not just confusing for like it makes sense for parents and the average public to be confused. But what you just referenced makes doctors confused. Like, they don't know how accurate the information that they're getting is. I mean, when the COVID shots came out, my doctor's office, which is an integrative office. I got different advice that my daughter did from the same office. In fact, the doctors, I think, like, live together. I think they're a couple. So, and I was older and I was told, don't get it. And my daughter, who was young, was told to get it from the same place. It's like, how do you make sense? So, like, clearly they're not on the same, they're just as confused as everybody else.
I think right now we're literally at the most confusing time about vaccines ever. This discussion hasn't been had because it wasn't allowed to be had. And so we now have very loud voices on both sides kind of arguing. Nobody's willing to sit at the table. Nobody's willing to have discussions, certainly not willing to have nuanced discussions. And what we need is debates. And that, again, it's why I wrote this book in the first place. It wasn't to tell people what to do. It was to have a discussion. It was to open up the information and kind of look at both sides, kind of a bird's eye view, and to be able to have discussions like this, because it you don't have to agree with me. I don't care if people agree with me. They don't have to. I'm not here to be right, right? And I'm just here to have these discussions and to learn. And I'm totally fine to change my opinion on things, to adjust things as we go. I'm just trying to present what I know. And what I know is so confusing. And I'm a doctor. I have a master's in epidemiology. And I've written a book on vaccines. And the more information that I get, the more confused that I am. So there's no way that parents can have any idea what to do. And I think that's extraordinarily frustrating. And the best way forward to me is to talk about it and to talk things through and to say, here's what we know. Here's what we don't know. Let's try to get more information that we do know. It's so arrogant. We're so arrogant in medicine right now that it's like we have the best vaccine schedule ever. We know exactly what to do. The other countries do things differently. We always improve and get better in general in theory. So we should be aiming in 10 years to have a better vaccine program, healthier kids than we have now. That should be our goal. And there should be no need to force your opinion down somebody's throat. Like, we need to have these discussions. And you need to get mad at me if you don't agree with what I say. That's fine. I don't care. Like, I don't care. You could be like, you're an idiot, Dr. Joel. Like, you're a crazy anti-vaxxer. I mean, obviously not. Like, kids in my office get vaccines. It's not that. It's just, I don't care if a kid gets 1,000 vaccines or zero. I want them to be healthy, and I want to figure out what the best thing is. And I think if we don't have these discussions now, we're going to have 500 vaccines in a couple years, and more isn't always better. And we are seeing a lot of that discussion play out right now because, you know, the schedule just changed in America, you know, fairly recently. And a lot of the...
How so? Can you touch on that?
So the CDC schedule, which is the main schedule that kids follow, Secretary Kennedy put out a new report. They basically took off a lot of the vaccines, or, you know, several of the vaccines that were on the schedule before. So we're vaccinating against 18 diseases, which is one of the highest in the world for what we recommend strongly. And they switched that down to 11, basically modeling it against Denmark, which Denmark does 10, and they're kind of the lowest in the Western industrial nations. So we're more modeling against that now. And they put some of the other vaccines into shared clinical decision-making. So basically the choice, the discussion between the provider and the patient. So hepatitis A, hepatitis B, RSV, flu, COVID, all used to be on the schedule and no longer are as the main recommendations.
So do you know if Denmark that we're modeling off of, do they have, I assume they have better general health outcomes, but there could be other things that are also going into that. Like they might eat better.
Right, right. So I mean, that's the debate, right? So that's what's going on right now because this just happened. And the, if you read the paper that they published, they just published on why they did it, a lot of it is around not that Denmark actually does it right, but that Denmark has very high rates of vaccine uptake. They have lower rates of chronic disease. They're generally healthier. And Denmark has basically decided, well, we want to prioritize the things that we feel like are most important. If we have too many vaccines on the schedule, then people are going to be hesitant. And there is a lot of mistrust in America. So that's kind of the, I guess the reasoning behind it is well, we have so much mistrust in America that we want to prioritize what we want to prioritize. I mean, it's a little interesting of a
that is interesting
way to take things and kind of move forward because there's a lot of debate around this because it was kind of unilaterally done by Secretary Kennedy, a few things that bypassed even ACIP.
Do you know if Denmark, I'm sorry to cut you off there, but do you know if Denmark mandates those things or those are just recommendations?
So, I mean, nobody really, so mandate's kind of the wrong word what people use, but nobody really mandates vaccines. They just, you need them usually for school. Most places don't require anything for school. They just have recommendations. So the CDC, for example, has recommendations. This is the schedule that's recommended. And some states, some countries, they require those recommendations for school or some of them. So they recommend 10. We now recommend 11. We used to recommend 18, but the recommendations are strong recommendations. Basically, do it unless you choose not to or get an exemption. So now it's been moved to a lesser, you know, less forceful.
So do you feel like that's progress? That's good?
I don't know. I mean, I think overall it opens up discussion. I'm not sure that I love the way that this went down because I don't think we got the research that we needed to back up the decision making that we had. Denmark is certainly very different than us. We didn't move to the middle. We moved to the other extreme. And like you said, it's really hard to pinpoint whether anything with Denmark's health has anything to do with vaccines, really. I mean, they're a very different population. They're much smaller. They have a much more streamlined. So like we have, you know, much more divide between rich and poor. We have a much larger poorer community. And we know that with these infectious diseases that the lower socioeconomic status individuals tend to do much worse.
Denmark Is that because they have like less vitamins in their diet or?
It's a mixture of things. It's certainly nutrition and also just access to care. Here in America, you might not have insurance, so you might be more hesitant to go to the hospital or go to the doctor. You might not be able to get there very easily. You might be worried it's going to cost you money. So you wait a little bit longer. You don't want to go to the hospital. You don't want to get seen. Maybe you don't have a doctor. So when you have a place that has universal health care, people are more likely to get care and maybe just generally overall healthier. So your risk from these diseases is a little bit lower. So there are just big differences between countries. That's not right or wrong. I mean, I don't think it's wrong to model what we're doing against countries that are doing better. From that standpoint, I don't have any problem with that. But I'm just very worried that there's a lot of kind of forcing things down people's throat without actually bringing in all the people that need to be part of this. And so you're just going to have a new recommendation that people won't follow, which that doesn't help. And then if, you know, Kennedy's not in there in 3 years, then they can just put it right back. So ultimately, whether it's good or bad, I don't know. I think it's hard for him to do anything. So he's just doing what he thinks is right. And that's fine. But ultimately, if we want to see change, we're going to need research and we're going to need to see the data that proves that that's better or worse. And if you want to see real changes in the vaccine schedule, you need that risk data, because ultimately, if you see that and you're like, well, the hepatitis B vaccine has this risk, it's much higher than the actual benefit. Therefore, that's why we shouldn't have it on our schedule. That doctors would agree with. If you could show it, right. If you could show it honestly, if you could be like, well, we don't think that the risk outweighs the benefit for the newborn hepatitis B, instead of just saying it, if you could prove it, there's a big difference there. So I think we're currently missing that data, and it's not his fault. I mean, it just doesn't exist. So gotcha. They have to hopefully go do that research, and then hopefully over time we'll get more of that, and maybe this is going to be the push to be like, well, we're taking it away, but we're going to start to work on proving it. And
if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you've probably heard me talk about how important it is to regulate your nervous system. This goes for healing, for focus, for just overall emotional well-being. But the reality is that even if we know the tools to help do this, whether it's breathing or meditation or just slowing down, it can still be really hard to stay regulated throughout a busy day. That's one reason I've really been interested in the Apollo wearable by Apollo Neuro. Sarah and I both use this device regularly and have found it very beneficial. It's a small wearable device that uses gentle vibrations, and they're designed to signal safety to your nervous system. What's fascinating is that those signals can help your body shift out of a stress state and into a calmer, more regulated state. What I like about it, most of all, is that even though it can work great alongside practices like meditation or breath work, the real value is that you can wear it throughout your day, even while you're at work, and just let it work its magic on your nervous system. The other standout use that I rely on is wearing it to bed. Not only does it help me fall asleep fast, but I often wake up around 3 a.m. and I can just tap the button on it and it will help lull me back to sleep quickly. If you want to learn more, check out the podcast episode with the founder, David Rabin, and you could explore more about the technology itself. But if you're someone that struggles with anxiety or feeling wired or overwhelmed, or you're simply looking for more nervous system support in daily life, it might be something worth exploring. You can learn more about the Apollo wearable and how it works and save $99 on a new device at apolloneuro.com/mindful or click the link in the show notes. I promise you won't regret this investment. I truly believe it's the best bang for the buck in the wellness tech space. Today's episode is supported by one of our affiliate partners, Sunlight and Saunas, and I want to share about them in a very real and personal way. Of all the health and wellness tools I've invested in over the years, whether it be the education, the movement practices, and just the myriad of modalities, our Sunlight and Sauna has honestly been the single greatest overall investment I've made for my well-being. Not because it fixes everything, but because of how consistently it supports my nervous system and my mood. I know many users of infrared saunas use it for the great cardiovascular benefits or the detoxification, which are obviously important, but for me personally, it's about how I feel. Using the sauna almost guarantees that I move through my day feeling more grounded, more regulated, and just more emotionally steady. Their full-spectrum infrared technology works at lower temperatures, which makes the experience feel more supportive rather than depleting. It's not about pushing through intense heat. It's about allowing the body to soften, to release, and to reset. For me, it's become a non-negotiable. It's an anchor in my self-care, a space to slow down, to breathe, and let my body do what it already knows how to do when it feels safe and supported. If you're someone who carries a lot, who tends to live in your head, or who's working to support your nervous system more intentionally, this is a tool that truly complements any other health-minded lifestyle habit, whether it's meditation, exercise, you name it. You can learn more about Sunlighten and explore their sauna options at sunlighten.com/mindful. They are running some of their biggest specials right now, so check them out and see which sauna is best for you. I assure you, it's an investment you won't regret.
And
when people talk about the risks of vaccines, what are they generally talking about? I mean, you hear autism thrown out there a bunch. What are the things that people say we need to be worried because vaccines or too many of them or over time cause ... Like, what are the big risks that we're looking at?
Yeah, well, I'd say there's two categories. There's short-term and long-term. So short-term, I think, is much simpler because you kind of see it right after. It's much easier to study. So you have the main things that you see, like a fever, you don't feel good, whether you're going to get sick from some other disease, you're affecting your immune system in some way in the short term. Myocarditis is something that we saw more recently. You know, seizures, dying, sudden infant death syndrome, all these things are concerns in the short term. So you get a vaccine, something happens to you in the next couple of days. That's one category. I don't think that's much of the concern for people. I mean, certainly.
Have you seen that? Like, as a pediatrician given stuff?
I've never seen any of the major things. I've certainly seen, you know, fevers, rashes, redness, swelling.
But those are very, like, temporary.
Those are temporary and they get better. And that's, they're not even necessarily, like, they're your body reacting to the vaccine that it's supposed to do. So that that doesn't bother me at all. I think if that's the only thing that you get, that's totally reasonable. You get an immune reaction, that's fine. I mean, certainly if it's related to sudden infant death syndrome in some way, that would be obviously concerning. Myocarditis is something that came up a lot with a COVID vaccine, so that's certainly concerning. But those, in general, I don't think are the big concerns from parents. I think the big concerns are if they're related to any sort of chronic conditions, because we're seeing this chronic disease explosion. So top of the mind would be autism. And then after that would be all the other chronic conditions. So all the autoimmune conditions, lupus, eczema, arthritis, asthma, allergies.
You're lumping. Those are all autoimmune conditions.
Autoimmune or just chronic conditions in general.
Gotcha.
So I would say that those are the big concerns, because we've seen this chronic disease explosion. About 50% of kids have a chronic condition. There's no question that it's not just vaccines. I mean, it's many things. It's certainly multifactorial.
Do you think they're contributing, though, to the 50%?
They may be. I think they are. They're meant to stimulate and affect your immune system. That's their job. The question of how they might affect that in the long term, or whether they affect certain kids, certain genetics in a way that it's not supposed to, I don't see how it couldn't. I mean, we know that it can cause Guillain-Barré syndrome, an autoimmune condition. We know that it can cause seizures. We know that it can cause encephalitis. So if it can do those things, I don't see why it couldn't affect certain kids.
Does it do that? Is it? Because so the idea is vaccine, you give a little bit of the thing that you're trying to like teach the body to be good at responding to, and then you give it with something that intentionally stimulates the immune system so that it becomes reactive, because that's what you want. But then that could, I guess, potentially backfire, because you are triggering the system to be reactive. And that's once you open that box, like we don't necessarily contain or can control how the body might shoot that in other directions, essentially, that overreaction.
I mean, that's true of everything that you do, right? Any medication, everybody's different. Everyone has different genetics. And so for each person, you could have a unique reaction. You could take Tylenol and some people could die, right? You could take water. You could drink too much water and people would die. Like everything potentially could have a reaction depending on how you take it, how much, where it goes, what happens, what's your detoxification, what else is going on? Are you sick currently? Like what's happening in your body? So all these things affect it. Most people, I think, do fine with a vaccine, but I'm sure there are certain genetics that you can't detoxify, or you're allergic to something, or you get a vaccine and for whatever reason, it goes to the wrong place. It goes to your brain. It goes to your heart. It just doesn't go as it's generally supposed to. Maybe you give the vaccine wrong, it goes to the wrong place. There are many reasons why something could go wrong for you, and your body is unique and complicated, and so you're supposed to create an immune response that's beneficial. But there's no logical reason to me, or no biological possibility, that for a certain, let's say, small percentage of the population, let's say 1 in a million, that it wouldn't have some sort of weird reaction that you can't predict. So the question then becomes, okay, I would say that's almost for sure possible. It certainly happens. There's no question about that. Now, how frequently? We have this massive increase in asthma. Is that because of vaccines? Is it increasing that by 5%, by 1%, by 0.1%, by 25%? How much of it? Because you are affecting the immune system. And if you do something, does that affect it in a way that we don't understand, that we're not intending, that we didn't expect? Maybe not. Maybe it has nothing to do with that. Maybe it's just the food, just the air. I don't know that answer. The only way you know that answer is if you study it, and just assuming that it doesn't is ridiculous to me. We have this massive problem with chronic disease. We don't have the massive problem we used to have with infectious disease. We have to balance those two. We don't want kids to get sick and die from diseases, but we also don't want kids to get sick from chronic disease. So we have to balance those two. And the correct answer is to say, I don't know. We don't have the evidence to prove that it does, but there's enough concern around it. There are hundreds of thousands of parents, if not more, that say, my kid was healthy today. They got a vaccine. They're not healthy tomorrow.
Yeah, a lot of those stories.
So those people are called anti-vaxxers, crazy. Like, that's a literal person who went in to get a vaccine.
It's crazy.
So they're not anti-vax. They just believe that a vaccine causes problem. Now, is it possible that you get a vaccine this morning, have a heart attack this afternoon, it has nothing to do with vaccines? Of course it is. But if a whole bunch of people go in this morning, get a vaccine, and they have a heart attack this afternoon, you should at least say, hey, is the vaccine causing those heart attacks? Right? Like, there's nothing wrong with that's what the data should be. And you say, okay, we have all these parents with the same story. They say, my kid was normal, air quotes. And then the next day, all sorts of problems happens and they had autism. That is important information that you got to say, look, these parents are saying this, we need to study that. We need to study it hard. We don't need to dismiss it. We don't need to say that this is crazy. These are woo-woo people. We have to look into this to see. That's science. That's what we're supposed to do. You're supposed to say, we don't believe that it does, but let's study it because other people do. Let's prove that it does or doesn't. There are ways to do that. There is research that we could do to look into this. We've never done it before. It needs to be done.
I'm not optimistic that it will get done. I love that you're out there banging the drum for it, but man, I just feel like as I get older and the closer I watch, we just get failed by the politicians or, you know, whoever's managing the system, we just get failed more and more by. But, you know, maybe the tide is turning and it'll take a long time, but maybe it is in the process of unfolding. And I hope that's the case. Another thing that is I would say just obvious about, and maybe there are different sizes of dosing, but I've heard that all these vaccines essentially have the same dose. And like, I've taken so many supplements over the years, probably a dozen or so like pharmaceutical medications over my life. And one thing that's clear is like, there's different doses for different reasons, for different people. Like, I'm 208 pounds right now. The idea that anything would be dosed the same for somebody 25 or 10% my size, but it's, I just can't imagine a situation where that makes sense. But in the world of vaccines, it seems like that's the case, right?
It is. I mean, really, the vaccines are basically the same dose for certainly for younger kids and older kids. We don't have different other than the whooping cough. It's a little different, but still basically the same, the Tdap and the Dtap. And you're basically giving the same thing to a kid as you are to a grown adult. So I agree. I do think it's also a little bit weird. But again, it goes back to you would have to identify that there's a safety concern to even have an acknowledgement that maybe younger kids would have an increased risk of something. So therefore we should have a smaller dose, or you have to have the safety signal first. You have to, if you just say everything's safe, it's like, well, it's just easier to give one dose that's the exact same size to everybody. It's more, it's easier for public health. It's easier to ship it around. You have fewer mistakes in terms of the office. So it's just simpler to give one dose for everybody. And if you don't have the thought process that maybe there's a side effect from that, maybe there's a risk, then obviously it's easier to just give one dose to everybody because that's the only thing you have to produce. You mass produce it. It's cheaper. It's easier. It's easier to handle. So I think we're sitting in that zone where it's like, well, if you identified that a younger kid had an increased risk, like a newborn, and you identify that the vaccine had some risk, then you might say, well, okay, how do we reduce that risk? Well, maybe for a newborn, we give a smaller dose. That would decrease their risk. But you have to have the risk in the first place. We don't have that. So you have to ask the first questions before we can get to those later questions, which that common sense doesn't really come into effect for vaccines because the assumption is that they have such a low side effect profile anyways, that why would you need to decrease the amount for a young baby because it's not going to cause a problem anyways. So I think that's why it is that way. But yeah, I mean, you give a medication, if you give antibiotic, whatever, it's like you're not giving the same dose to a bit newborn that you're giving to a 10-year-old. But for the vaccine, you are. So
what do you do? I mean, you're working with parents trying to help them navigate this seemingly impossible like terrain. What do you generally recommend, or what do you generally find people agreeing to or like getting on board with, or where do you find where you're on the same page and like this is on average the plan that we deploy based on all this kind of noisy information we have?
Yeah, at the moment, I mean, here's the thing. The only thing you can recommend is what's recommended. And the CDC schedule is what's recommended. I mean, you know, now there's a lot of craziness, but let's just say in general, right? You're recommending the CDC schedule. And I think it'd be very arrogant of me to be like, Dr. Joel knows better than the CDC. So therefore, you should do what I think and not them. That's the gold standard. That's what's always been recommended. And so if you want to defer to something, that's the reasonable thing to defer. Anything outside of that becomes personal choice. And I just try to walk parents through risk versus benefits and help them make the decision that makes sense for them. So I don't tell people to do it or not do it. I tell people, here's what the recommendations are. If you want to do anything different, let's talk about it. Let's talk about what that means and try to risk stratify. If you're going to do a slow schedule, like which ones seem more important, which ones are more at risk for your kid, which ones are more deadly, what things haven't we seen in 50 years? And that's usually how people risk stratify. If they come in and say, you know, oh, we don't want to do any vaccines, we don't believe in vaccines, then I will go through, okay, what are the risks of not vaccinating with them, just so they understand. And then if that's their choice, then you just document it, and that's what it is. So,
do you find a lot of the parents are going on their like personal route outside of the recommended CDC thing?
In my office, it's obviously self-selecting. So, yeah.
Because people are coming to you because they want to do that.
Yeah, a lot of people are coming to our office because they at least know that I'm open to having discussions. Majority are not, I would say, anti-vax. The majority get vaccines in my office. A lot of them do a slow schedule, but they still do it.
Schedule just means not hammering them all like that first day that the baby pops out, spreading them out over what?
They still do them, but they maybe do one at a time. Yeah, over the years. But instead of doing five, you know, four or five on one day, they might just do one at a time every couple of months. So they still tend to do all the vaccines, but just slower. That would be the majority, I would say. In my office, there are, you know, some that don't and some that do the regular, but most do somewhere in the middle. And I think that's fine.
What does the schedule show, Joel, for like what a kid's supposed to get the day that they're born?
The day that they're born. So within the first, let's say, in the hospital in the first 48 hours, if you were to do everything, you would get a hepatitis B vaccine, a vitamin K vaccine, and an RSV vaccine.
Wait, a vitamin K vaccine? What does that mean?
So technically it's not a vaccine in the sense that you're giving immune protection, vitamin K. It's an immunization, so it's like, you know, same thing. It's an injection, but you're getting vitamin K. It helps with clotting to decrease your risk of bleeding.
Okay. So they're giving them a vitamin.
A vitamin, but it's
one fat-soluble vitamin. Okay, so yeah. Hep B, vitamin K, and then what was the other one?
RSV, respiratory syncytial virus. So that's another. Again, it's not exactly a vaccine. It's more an immunization because it's antibodies. So it's similar to something like breast milk, where you're giving antibodies to protect. It's not creating an immune response, but it is protecting them from RSV.
Okay, so Hep B is the one that kind of stands out of those. Is like. Is this a good risk reward?
To me, of those three, that would be the least beneficial, as long as you know that mom's Hep B negative, nobody has hepatitis B in the family. The risk to a baby to get hepatitis B, if no one in the family has it, especially mom, is really, really low. It's not zero, but it's like 1 in 1 million, 1 in 10 million in that range. So you could theoretically, bang into a needle. Somebody could come by and bleed on you. That's theoretically possible, but just very unlikely in those first few months. So
Is it treatable if like a 1 month old?
It's not treatable. So that's the concern. So if a baby gets Hep B, I mean, you can manage it, but there's a high risk of death or liver cancer long term if a baby gets it. So it is very severe if a baby gets it. There's no question about it. But the risk to actually get that disease if you're negative is extremely low. So those are the things, again, you need to discuss that, right? Some people would say, you know what? There's a high risk of death if my kid gets it. I don't want them to have any risk of that. I'm fine with vaccines. I'm going to do it. Fine. Other people are going to say, well, you know, I understand that there's a big risk for my baby if they get it, but I don't have hepatitis B. My partner doesn't have hepatitis B. I don't think anyone's coming to bleed on my baby. I'm comfortable with a 1 in 1 million risk or whatever it is of hepatitis B. I'll just do it later. They can do it when they're older. That should be also fine. And a lot of people do that. Most people in my office, I would say that, of all the vaccines, the newborn hepatitis B vaccine is by far the most skipped of any vaccines. And then they just tend to do it later.
I think if I could go back in time when my kids were born, I would do things differently. But I'm kind of glad that I can't imagine trying to face that decision. I'm kind of glad I was ignorant then, because this feels like for a young parent, like it could be very emotionally and mentally challenging to try to navigate. I mean, there's I spend time in nature a lot, and there's part like there's the hippie in me that looks out and I'm like, there's no animals out here getting anything, any kind of shots, and they seem to be fine. There's part of me that's like, we shouldn't need any of this stuff. And maybe we do because we've just jacked up our general health because of, you know, what we've done to our environment or whatever. But it's like, there's part of me that just thinks the whole thing's crazy.
Well, I mean, okay. So first of all, you know, I just posted on social media maybe like a week or two ago, a post just like that. I'm like, I just feel so bad for parents right now because I don't know how any average parent is supposed to navigate this? Like, how do you navigate it when the CDC, HHS says one thing, your doctor says a different thing, American Head of Pediatrics says another thing, your social media influencer follower that you love says a totally different thing, the other one, it's like everybody's giving you wildly different opinions, and you're like, I just want to keep my kid healthy. I don't want to give them a vaccine to my kid to get autism or some sort of problem. And my friend's kid got autism and they swear it's this. And, you know, my doctor says it doesn't cause autism. So therefore, I just don't know who to trust and what to do. And I don't want my kid to get a disease, but I also don't want them to have a bad reaction and they just feel stuck. And I think it's really hard right now because it's so confusing. And I feel really bad for parents who are trying to make these decisions. I have a newborn baby right now because I think it's really tough and there's very mixed messaging. And I think that's just a massive problem. I think it's very tough. And I don't have an easy answer for parents. I think they got to find people they trust. And ultimately, as of right now, you're going to have to take in as much information as you can. I think right now you need to get educated. You know, it's like, oh, how does it, you have to read some books. Like, I just think you have to read some stuff if you're going to get kids and you're going to have any sort of question around vaccines. If you just trust the CDC, let's say, or former CDC, their American Pediatrics, and you want to do the regular schedule, fine, that's easy. But if you want to do anything else, you're going to have to read some stuff, and then you're going to have to decide what you're personally comfortable with, because ultimately there's a war right now on this discussion, and it's back and forth everywhere. So nobody's going to have the same answers. You're going to have to decide what you want to do.
And you still, and nobody has full information because the safety side hasn't really been studied.
Right. We're missing some pieces of it. So you're going to have to make a decision based on what we do know. And so that I think, you know, is very, very tough for parents right now, because it depends who you're going to listen to. And you're going to have multiple different angles and different opinions on everything that you're supposed to do. And it used to be like, oh, just do it. And that was kind of mostly what you heard, but that's not necessarily the case anymore. So.
Right. And there's social pressures. I mean, the social pressures around the COVID shot situation was crazy. I mean, I know that so many people were, just lost so much socially because of like how they sided around getting this shot.
And that's why I think we are where we are, because people lost trust in the institutions. And so they do hear what Secretary Kenney is saying, and they might not have listened or trusted him 3 years ago, but they do more so now, or at least they have a respect for some distrust in the system. And they're like, well, I was forced to do this thing and told that it was going to stop transmission when they knew that it wasn't. And you were saying that it's safe, even though it wasn't totally safe and you couldn't really know that it was safe. And
a lot of people don't know that, what you just said. It's not that it didn't stop transmission. They knew that it didn't, but they said it anyway. Like,
right. They
a lot of people don't know that they were lied to. They still think, there's a lot of people out there who still think that's true.
Yeah, and these are things that they couldn't possibly know at the time because they didn't study them. They didn't necessarily originally study it for transmission, and certainly didn't know that it stopped transmission. And that makes no sense that it would stop transmission, because that's not how those kind of vaccines even work, or generally work. There was no reason to ever say that the vaccine was safe, because you couldn't possibly know that it was safe because it was new. So you could only say we don't know that we have any safety signals. We haven't seen any problems, but we don't know what it's going to be like in 5 years because it hasn't been 5 years. But they just said it was safe and it's safe to do it. And you know, and if you've had the disease, then you still need to get a vaccine because you don't have immunity, which is also insane, because of any disease you ever get, if you get the actual disease, you have better protection than from the vaccine. So there's just a lot of things that didn't make any sense.
Right.
And
they never told you anything to do outside of, like, I remember getting COVID and, you know, to me, just being like health minded for a long time, and I guess paying attention to like the health sphere of the internet, it wasn't like rocket science to figure out what to do to try to support myself to get better. Like, I got better in a couple days just from like really low hanging fruit, the things that people have used for a really long time to get better when you don't feel good. You know, basic nutrients, the chicken soup type stuff. Take a little extra vitamins, get rest, make chicken soup. That kind of stuff, I think, goes a long way. And I'm not saying it's the answer and like everybody will just be fine if they do that. But it was definitely kind of insulting almost to hear the messaging disregard all of that and act like there was only one answer, and it was the one answer that made large corporations insane amounts of money.
Correct. And we saw that very clearly, especially as you look back now. And so it's no wonder that people don't trust that system, because they say, look, you lied to me about this, you lied to me about that. My friend got a bad reaction. I had a bad reaction. Okay, if this happened with that vaccine, what about all the rest of them? I had a horrible reaction from the COVID vaccine, so therefore, I don't want to give my kid other vaccines. Maybe the other vaccines do that. You told me that this was safe. Well, you're telling me the other vaccines are safe. Are they safe? I don't know. Look at what happened. Like, we watched this in real time. So we're sitting here now on the other end of that. And I don't know, probably more than half the people, probably three quarters of the population doesn't trust vaccines at all, or certainly are skeptical to some degree where they weren't before. They just didn't think about it. And now they're like, do I really want to give my kid all these vaccines? How many vaccines are there?
And the censorship did not help, because it's like, yeah, so if it was legit, 100%, everything what they said, you wouldn't need to censor opposition. It would just speak for itself.
Before, you would just trust your doctor, and doctor would say, well, we recommend this vaccine, it's going to protect your kid. And people don't trust doctors anymore, because they said, we're going to give you this COVID vaccine, you're never going to get sick, this thing is safe. And then they had a reaction themselves. So you lost trust. Trust is gone, and it's going to take a long time to get it back. And when you mix in a lot of the concern and the new research and the new information kind of coming out from the top, parents have no idea what to do. And it's going to be confusing for a while, and it's just starting. I mean, there's still three more years of Kennedy at least. And there's going to be more things come out, more research, more decisions. And a lot of this discussion is good and useful. It's needed. But we're in a very turbulent time for parents, because we do need this research so that way it can push forward the information and does push forward the discussion in the long term. But in the short term, it makes it real confusing because, you know, for example, like, I'm in California and the Hep B vaccine is no longer a recommended vaccine technically by the CDC, but it's still required for school. So what do you do if you're a parent? You're like, well, I don't think my kid really needs Hep B. I'm not really worried about it. It's not even a recommended CDC vaccine anymore. And yet you're going to require me to get it for school. Well, I don't want that. Like, there are a lot of weird controversies right now that because this is all happening so fast. So I think in the long run, it'll settle. But in the short term, it makes it extraordinarily confusing for the parent. And then you're like, okay, well, shared clinical decision making, you only need to get these if you're high risk. Well, what's the definition of high risk? Because pretty much every kid's going to get rotavirus. So is my kid high risk for rotavirus? How do you define that? Could they get hepatitis A? Of course they get hepatitis A. There's hepatitis A outbreaks every year, all the time. So what defines high risk? What makes me worried? It's impossibly confusing for a parent who doesn't have that time. And even if they did, I don't have the answer, so I don't see how they could.
Well, at least you wrote a book to help create a framework to think about it.
Yeah, I think it helps. The people that read my book, I mean, it's been thousands of people now. I got a lot of positive reaction back. And I think it really helps you to understand the landscape. And I think that's important, because if you're a parent who has no idea what's going on, you're just listening to the news, it doesn't get into the details that you need. I think you need the background to understand the discussion, so that way you can start to formulate opinions. And I try to run through, okay, so, the beginning of the book is like, all right, here are the diseases, here are how severe they are, here's how many people get them. Like, you need to know that information. Then you need to know the controversies and the concerns. And then once you have that background, now you can start listening to all the new stuff that's happening and kind of understand where things are coming from, where Secretary Kennedy is coming from, where these new recommendations are coming from. And then you can start to synthesize that and hopefully come to some at least semi-educated place. And I think you'll feel better as a parent if you're making that decision, at least with some education. You're not going to be able to read everything, but you can certainly read a book or two, or, listen to some podcasts or whatever, and get some understanding, because you can't get it from the news. It's so, I do the news all the time, and it's so stupid. Like, you're like literally there for like a minute or two, and they're like, the world's blowing up. Oh, and here's Dr. Joel to talk about the newest car seat. It's like, okay, fine. You talk for like a minute, or you they ask you a question about vaccines, and you like, is this change good or bad? And you have like, 8 seconds to respond for like a 3-hour answer. So, it's not very helpful to look at the news, but reading a book or, listening to some long form, that can be helpful to start to get some understanding of what's going on.
What's your take on Secretary Kennedy?
I think overall it's he's needed. I mean, I think he's the response to COVID. And unfortunately, because of everything that happened for public health, we went the other direction and have someone that's pushing back. I think we absolutely have a chronic disease epidemic. We are unhealthy like we've never been before, and we need somebody to change that. And he's shaking things up, no question about it. And we need a lot of that shakeup. We need someone who's comfortable to go through the craziness and just do what they think needs to be done. And I don't know that everything he's doing is correct. I don't think anyone that's ever there, you're going to agree with everything, but at least he's shaking things up. And I think that's good. And it's kind of the other extreme. So extremes are not usually good.
Right.
I think the middle is good, but we need that other extreme to kind of push back on where things were. And then I hope, you know, over the next decade, it comes back to the middle a little bit more, because he's doing some stuff on his own that doesn't make a lot of sense. He's not really bringing in the people that he needs to bring in. Like, doctors are kind of making decisions on their own. But I think that's kind of what he needs to do, because he's not going to be able to do anything otherwise. Mm. So I respect what he's doing, but he's got a long uphill battle ahead. And I hope that in the long run, as he does some of these things that he ultimately wanted to do, then hopefully he'll work his way to including a little bit more of a support of the institutions that he needs, so this can be more long-term, and maybe give a little on some of the things so it comes back to the middle, but you get some buy-in from the institution. So I hope in the long run it will be, but I mean...
I like him. My impression is that he's not lying to me.
I don't know if he's right about everything, but
I think that he's not lying to me. Whereas most people in those high positions throughout all politics, I just feel like they're lying to me.
I think he's doing what he thinks is best. And I think that's better than having a politician who's lying, who's just following what a company pays them to do. So I think from that standpoint, there's no question that he is moving things in a direction that he feels like is better, and we need that. I don't think that any one person should be in charge of everything,
right.
And their opinion should supersede all other things. And there are, you know, checks and balances for a lot, but ultimately, you know, maybe in the short term, that's kind of what we need.
But so, also, I think I don't know his exact age. I think he's around 70. And when I see someone that's like in the shape that he is at 70, like, I know that doesn't happen by accident. Like, you have to be so intentional and mindful about how you live, because it's such an uphill battle to be healthy right now with our food supply, our polluted environment. Like, there's so many forces making it hard to be healthy that when I see someone that's healthy at that age, I feel like there's a lot to learn from them. Like, in some way, that alone is like a role model, and I feel like it's good that he's promoting the health side of things.
Yeah, well, and I think it's really important that we have to be able to kind of step back a little bit and be like, well, you know, even if you hate his vaccine policies or you hate his stance on vaccines, he's still doing so many other things, right? And you could disagree on certain aspects or certain things. You can say, well, I don't believe that he should have changed the CDC schedule. But that doesn't mean that you can't also support his change of food or making healthier food policy or pushing back against soda or any of those things. So I think they just did that, by the way,
the food thing.
Yeah,
they redid the whole. What's your take on the new, I guess, food pyramid?
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, I think that we clearly have a major problem with food in this country. Anyone that, you know, argues against that, it's ridiculous, right? We obviously have terrible food. We're overweight and obese. We have diabetes rates that are skyrocketing, and chronic disease. That's, you know, 75% of adults have a chronic disease. So what we're doing is not working. And yes, there have been some changes over the years from the original food pyramid, which was a long time ago, but the messaging has been terrible. The messaging has not been, don't eat ultra processed food, don't eat sugar, you know, minimize it as much as possible, eat whole foods, cook at home. You can, you know, argue about the minutiae and this and that and saturated fat and all these things, fine. But ultimately, the messaging is strong, the imaging is strong, and we need a PR movement that shifts things forward. And so I think it's an excellent move forward, because yes, there were some of these things that were in the past, and the arguments kind of against are like, well, you know, we have these kind of food recommendations, but people just don't do it. Okay, well, then your recommendations failed. And even if you're redoing the exact same thing, but just rebranding it, well, that's what you need to do. So a lot of it's just rebranding and being stronger on some of the positions that we already have. And some things are a little different, but the minutiae is not important right now. The big things are. And we can argue, and they can, you know, make little adjustments here to the percentage of saturated fat or, you know, whatever people are arguing about right now. There are a few things, but we shouldn't be arguing that ultra processed food is bad and too much sugar is bad. and eating whole foods is not bad. So if that's the main messaging, great. Every single human should get behind that and then argue the details after and adjust those as you go. But I'm very happy with those changes. And I think, again, it's like from a grand scale, he's doing good things. These are good things. We're moving in a good direction. You don't have to agree on everything. You don't have to agree on the way that he did it. I know there is a lot of question marks around the way that they brought this out and the way that they kind of disregarded some of the stuff that was done before. But whatever. I mean, ultimately, it's what needs to be done. And for me, as someone who cares about kids' health, I just care that we're moving in a better direction. And this is a better direction than it was. And I will support that.
Yeah, well said. I agree. Joel, between a shot and a hard place, anything else you would like to add about your book, who that's for, what it's aiming to accomplish, or anything?
Yeah, I mean, well, thanks for having me on. You can follow me at Dr. Joel Gator on Instagram or X, or on Substack, also called Between a Shot and a Hard Place. So the book, I mean, it's for everyone, really. Any parents that are interested in vaccines, anyone that's interested in vaccines, professionals that want to learn more and kind of get the background research. So I think it's a big topic. It's an important topic. I had no idea how much my Substack would blow up. I mean, there's almost 100,000 people on it now. And it's doing really well. And not because I'm like some magical writer or anything, but I think people are just really interested in this topic. And I try to write, again, as much from an unbiased perspective as I can, and trying to give both sides. And I think that's something that parents appreciate and need. And, you know, I'll keep doing it. So it's the best that I can do for now.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm really glad you reached out. I enjoyed talking to you about this. I know we could talk a lot longer, but I'll respect your time here. For the listeners, always grateful for your listening. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. And I know it's a charged topic. I would love to hear what some people have to say about it in the comments, but I'll ask you to be nice and keep it, you know, this is the idea of this conversation is to have conversations and to have better dialogue. So let's, as a population, as a society, become more skillful at talking about the things that are charged and that are hard to discuss so that we can work through these nuances and help everybody, you know, navigate the hard thing of being, you know, a human on this planet these days. So I appreciate that. And again, appreciate your listening. And I hope everybody has a great day. Thanks again.